This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
We recently discussed the impending pullback in financial markets, and now we're beginning to see some of the predicted softness. And today we're going to delve into the looming risk for stocks and the potential for a sustained breakdown in financial markets, which could pose challenges to investment strategies that have worked for decades. I'm Andy Gersher, and this is Gains. Let's bring on Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, always great to have you on the Gains podcast.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's always great to join you.
Yeah, and the last time we had you on, we were talking about some of the threats that we saw coming, and now the markets have started to give a little bit, even though not too much, but you know, the Dow is probably 5%, the S&P around 4% off those highs, and the NASDAQ maybe down 3.5%. It has come off those highs, and we've seen some weakness, and that's where I want you to kind of pick up today. We talked about a month ago ahead of this, and now some of the stuff we were talking about is starting to come to fruition a little bit. So just start there, Jim.
Yeah, when we spoke last, Andy, one of the, I think, focus points in our conversation was the consumer price index for March that was going to come out on April 10th. And my expectation was that it was going to jump more than expected, and that would dim prospects for a June rate cut by the Fed, as well as potentially the 3 rate cuts that Wall Street had kind of begrudgingly accepted. As everyone knows, at the beginning of the year, Wall Street was looking for 6 cuts. So the CPI came in hotter than expected, and we saw Treasury yields increase, which was one of the responses I thought likely. The dollar was expected to rally. It did. And the S&P was expected to sell off and decline. So, you know, the markets are trying to deal now with the idea that, okay, we're not going to get as many rate cuts as we really thought likely. And the go-to narrative has been, and this is what has allowed the market to hold up, despite, you know, going from 6 cuts to now it's less than 2 cuts that are being expected, is the economy. The economy has continued to grow at a decent clip. And that has acted as the fallback position in terms of, well, we're not going to get our cuts, but the economy's okay. Earnings are going to go up 12% this year, and that's all we need. So the real risk going forward, I think, Andy, is at some point in time in coming months, if the economy shows signs of slowing, that would upset that narrative that we don't have to worry as long as the economy is in good shape.
Were you surprised that Wall Street was misreading the Fed, thinking they were going to just cut away, when it was pretty apparent with the data,
right,
which you and I look at,
yep,
that there was no way that was going to happen? And then, again, this all comes during a presidential election year.
Yeah. So, and that's been one of the reasons Wall Street also thought for sure there'd be rate cuts, especially in June, that the Fed would want to get it done, comfortably before the conventions and the elections, so that there wouldn't be any finger pointing at them as, you know, trying to influence the outcome of the election. But as you noted, Andy, we discussed the low unemployment rate near a 50-year low, the fact that inflation was going to be stubborn, and it's going to continue to be stubborn as we go forward. A lot of it is just the takeaway values from 12 months ago. So for your listeners, the CPI, the personal consumption expenditure index, all these inflation data points are 12-month rates of change. So what they basically do is they subtract the number from 12 months ago, and then they add whatever the current month is. And so the CPI for March of 2023 was 0.08%, which meant a very, very low takeaway value, which meant that if the CPI came in at 0.3, 0.4 for the March of 24, the headline number was going to jump from 3.2 to as much as 3.5, which is exactly what happened. In the second half of this year, and as you know, the Fed puts more emphasis on the PCE, the Personal Consumption Expenditure Index. In the first half of 2023, it went up on average 35 basis points per month. So the second half of last year was 17 basis points. So what that means, just simple mathematics, is in order for the PCE to decline in the second half of this year consistently, the monthly change from July of 24 to December will have to be less than 0.17% per year. And in the last couple of months, it's been running at 0.3%. So the table is set, Andy, for inflation to remain sticky for an extended period of time. Jay Powell gave a speech today and effectively said, inflation isn't coming down the way we expected, and we're ready, willing, and able to keep rates where they are for as long as it takes. So that, the market has to deal with that. And the point I would make is the longer that the Fed keeps the funds rate where it is, that means the prime rate, small businesses, the loan rate that they're having to pay their bank, auto loan rates, credit card rates, they all remain high. And so that's one of the reasons why I believe the economy is going to slow more than expected in coming months, because policy is, in terms of the level of borrowing rates, is relatively restrictive. And the longer they stay that way, the greater the squeeze, I think, on the real economy.
But they need to maintain to keep inflation in check, correct?
Well, here's the thing that I've been talking about, and we've discussed this, is that from the Fed's point of view, they're not looking at the next 3 to 6 months in terms of, all right, is inflation going to get down to 2% and stay down? They're looking at, okay, what does the next 18 months and longer look like? And one of the reasons why I thought Wall Street was just, out of touch with reality in terms of the Fed cutting aggressively is that the risk is if they start to add stimulus, in other words, lower the funds rate three times, which, was the consensus up until a few weeks ago,
Not for us, by the way. Not for us. I said for us, by the way, though. I just want to put that out there. We called this one right. So just go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And we got to remember that because, like a stop clock, we got it right, Andy. I'm just being facetious. Yeah, but anyway, now the point being seriously is that from the Fed's perspective is if they add stimulus, then 12, 18 months from now, the economy is going to respond to that stimulus and pick up some steam. Well, with the unemployment rate near a 50-year low and inflation comfortably above what they deem their target and not showing any signs that it's headed directly toward their target, adding stimulus meant that they were taking a real risk that, inflation may remain relatively tame in 2024, but in 2025, inflation would have a more likelihood of increasing. And what the Fed and Powell has talked about this, as have numerous other FOMC members, is they want to avoid the mistakes of the 1970s. And there were twofold. A, when inflation picked up in the late 60s and in the mid-70s, the Fed aggressively raised the funds rate But that only tipped the economy into a recession. The Fed then was forced to cut rates aggressively to deal with the recession. And the net result is the CPI and inflation measures kept working their way higher throughout the decade of the 70s. And what Powell has said as recently as March 20th, during his press conference after the FOMC meeting, that, you know, history tells us we want to be careful not to ease prematurely, so that ultimately then we're forced to go back to raising rates.
You know, I just wanted you to touch on this real quick. It's not like inflation is dropping. I mean, the toothpaste is out of the tube. So a lot of those higher prices we're paying are now permanent, and we're just not seeing increases from there. But, you know, we're still paying much higher for a whole basket of goods. And I just pick up on that, too.
Yeah, because, okay, President Biden, and understandably, you know, has noted, hey, inflation was 9, now it's down to, he likes to say 3, but obviously it's not quite there based on recent data points. But the annual rate of change has indeed obviously fallen from 9 to, call it, 3.5. The problem for most consumers and what consumers are reacting to is when they go to the grocery store and they think back a few years ago, what the prices that they're paying are up 30-40% relative to where they were 3-4 years ago. Their wages might be up 15-20%, you know, yippee, but in terms of their cost of living has increased beyond what the wages have increased. So consumers aren't responding to, oh, inflation is down from 9 to 3.5. They're responding to, my income has gone up by 15%, but my cost of living has gone up by 25, 30, 35%. You know, things like car insurance. Well, cars shot up, you know, in 2021 and 22, and they have much more technology in them. So they're much more expensive to fix, even a fender bender, you know, type of thing. And so insurance over the last year, and people, by the way, are getting into more accidents. So that confluence of things, insurance premiums are up about 40%. Well, you know, if your wages are up 15 to 20 and you get a bill that's gone up significantly over the last 2-3 years, you're responding to that bill. And so that, I think, is to your point, Andy, is, yeah, the annual rate has come down. But the cumulative increase in prices that we're all paying outweighs whatever our incomes have gone up. And that's why consumers are unhappy, if you will, with the economy, irrespective of the decline that we've seen over the last 18 months.
And that's an important point to make. I think a lot of people, scratch their head when they hear the headlines, but it's good to make that distinction. And then also, why, if they didn't get a handle on this, nobody would have been able to afford to eat. I mean, it was getting kind of scary, and that's why it's so important that we don't see something like that occur again in the not-too-distant future, say 18 months out, a couple of years out.
Yep, and that's really what the Fed's trying to do. It's kind of like, all right, we raised the funds rate to a modestly restrictive level. We didn't want to jack it more because then that would increase the odds of a recession. So what they've tried to do is get up to a level that's relatively restrictive. It's like putting flaps on an airplane. You know, you don't put them all the way down. You put them partially down so that the plane slows gradually so you can hopefully make a soft landing. And so that's what the Fed's trying to accomplish. And the net result is they're going to hold policy rates. I don't think an increase in the funds rate is likely anytime soon. And the other thing I will mention, Andy, is in the 1970s, a big part of those inflation surges that took place in 73, 74, 79, and 80 were a result of huge increases in crude oil prices. In 1973, crude went from $3 a barrel to $12. By 1979, it was up to 36. So I don't think we're going to see. I mean, we live in a dangerous world, as we are reminded almost daily. So, you know, oil prices would have to go up to like $250 a barrel to $600 a barrel to equate what happened in the 1970s. I just think that's very unlikely. So I'm not in the, you know, I've been talking about inflation was going to pick up, hold, and remain sticky. I am not in the camp that thinks, oh my goodness, inflation's, you know, going to be rocketing back to 5 and 6%. I think that's very unlikely.
As we look at markets and we've seen them give way a little bit, you know, the big question is how far will they go? And we're going to talk about that right when we get back from a break. We got to take a quick break. Hey, be sure to subscribe, follow, and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If that's an option for you. I've been told that's podcast gold. Totally appreciate the solid there. And as always, subscribe and turn on those notifications so you know when a new Gains episode drops. We drop Gains episodes on Wednesday mornings. We'll be right back after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover, all for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
All right, back with Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at macrotides.com. in San Diego. So, yes, as we've seen markets give away a little bit here, not much off of all-time highs, but where do they go from here? What kind of downward pressure could we see?
I think very, very short term, Andy, we're probably close to a trading low. If the S&P drops to near 5,000, the market is oversold after the drubbing of the last handful of days. So if the S&P drops to near 5,000, my expectation will be is there'll be a rally that carries back up. I doubt it will get much above 5,150. And then I think in all likelihood, we will see another decline take hold that has the potential of taking the S&P down under 4,900, maybe 4,850. That's about where the 382 retracement is of the rally from last October's low at 4104 to the high we saw in April at 5265. The 38% retracement of that comes in near that, just under 4850. I think that seems to be a reasonable target. Last year, as you know, the S&P peaked in late July, declined until near the end of October. So it declined for about 7 to 8 weeks. The total decline was 10%. So that to me was kind of an outline of what was likely to happen as we hit those highs above 5260, looking for a pullback in the 7 to 10% range. And I think that's what's going to likely unfold. Time-wise, that would suggest mid to late May, if the time is similar to the amount of time we saw in last year's correction. So I think near term, a bounce, but I think the market is going to work its way lower going into late May.
What do you see on the economic side as the biggest threat? We have talked about some of them not too long ago, the commercial real estate issues and some of the other things. What's the biggest risk to the economy right now?
Well, I think the biggest is going to be the labor market. You know, one of the things that people have been hanging on is look at job growth, up 300,000 in March, solid number, hours worked were up a little bit, and so forth. But there are some under-the-surface things, Andy, that are, have been showing up that, to me, if history is any guide, suggests that we're going to see a market slowing in job growth as we get beyond the middle of this year. And one of the things I'll point out, and other people have discussed this, but the establishment survey measures how many jobs were created each month. And part of their definition is if somebody says, you know what, I'm not making enough money to pay my bills, I'm going to go get a second part-time job. The establishment survey counts that as a new job.
Even though it's a person taking on another position.
Correct. So what we have seen is an increase of about 950,000 new jobs since February of last year, while full-time employment has declined by about 250,000. That's a huge gap between those two surveys. Now, the household survey doesn't accept, gee, working two part-time jobs? Sorry, you're one person, you can only have one job. So what we've seen is household survey, which doesn't double count part-time workers, that has been far weaker. As I said, a loss of 250,000 compared to a gain of 920 or 50,000. Now, the thing I discussed in the April macro tide is going back to like 2000, 2001, as well as 2007 and 8. What happened back then was that there was a divergence. The establishment survey kept showing more jobs being created. The household survey showed, nope, we're actually losing full-time jobs. And ultimately, that led to a more significant slowdown and ultimately a recession. So I think something similar is happening. Now, some people have talked about immigration, lifting part-time jobs. I'm sure that explains part of the big difference. It's about a 1.3 million difference in terms of part-time jobs and full-time jobs. And I think there's probably some seniors who quit their job, retired. And then all of a sudden, the cost of living went up so much. It's like, you know what? I can work, 10, 15 hours a week. Gives me something to do. I make a little extra money.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
Okay. So I think there's some of that going on. But it's also employers who have cut back on overtime hours. They've cut back on temporary workers significantly. They've cut back on hours worked. So if you're trying to control your labor costs, those are the things you do. Because you're worried about things slowing down, or maybe you're starting to see things slow down. The last thing they want to do is lay people off, especially as we've seen in the last couple of years. It was so hard for employers to find somebody qualified to work. You want to hang on to those people. So that's a natural thing that happens in every business cycle. So to me, the forward-looking indicators are suggesting that we're going to see job growth slow. I think the unemployment rate will start to tick up as we get past mid-year. And historically, Andy, about 12 to 15 months after the last rate increase, is another pressure point on the labor market historically. Well, the last increase was July of 23. So it's another thing that says, you get past mid-year, you're in that window of time. And we've talked about this too, the yield curve. Everybody went nuts when the yield curve inverted in July of 2022. Oh, my God, we're going to have a recession. And then last year, oh, my God, we're going to have a recession. And the thing I kept pointing out is the average lead time going back to 1950 between when the yield curve inverts and the onset of a recession is 19 months. You add 19 months to July of 2022, and you're in the January-February time frame of 2024. So a lot of things in my
wow, that's really telling. That's kind of what we've been targeting time-wise.
Yeah. And again, think about it in terms of if you're a small business and you're paying 10% for borrowed money and the Fed hasn't cut rates and now your loan comes due, and it was maybe a year ago 7%, now all of a sudden it's 10. You know, so the bite from higher interest rate on small businesses is a real thing. And the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which basically is a survey of small businesses, 20 employees or less, are predominantly their membership. The number of the percent of small firms intending to hire dropped from 18% in February to 12% in March. Historically, Andy, a decline of that magnitude, as well as getting down to that level near 12%, going back the last 40, 50 years, inevitably within 6 months, you're seeing more weakness show up in the labor market. So to me, that is going to be, I think, if that begins to happen, that will be troublesome for the equity market, because they've been able to ignore, we're not getting our rate cuts, but we got the economy. And if we see the labor market start to give way, I think the market is going to react strongly. And the other thing is, because inflation has been stubborn, the Fed, the first signs of weakness, the Fed isn't going to overreact and start cutting rates right away. Because inflation is still elevated.
Right. They're not going to immediately start cutting the second there's a soft jobs report or something along those lines.
Yeah, they're going to look at it like, that's just 1 month. We'll see what next month brings.
They always say they're data dependent. So, it takes more than just one report to start a trend as well.
Yes, exactly. And so to me, that creates, because inflation has started to, tick up in recent months, that means the Fed is going to be a little bit slow to react to the very first signs of slowing in the economy, unless, obviously, they're very, very pronounced. If a full-blown war develops in the Middle East, that obviously changes everything potentially overnight. But just taking things as we know they exist today and are likely to continue, I just think the table is set for a period of time when the economy shows signs of slowing, not a tremendous amount, but just some signs of slowing, which causes, the idea that, our earnings may not go up 12% this year and so forth. That just creates a concern about potential stagflation, growth slowing, but inflation still being stubborn. That historically has not been a good combination for equity valuations.
And then on the trading front, on the equity front, gains listeners who've, since last fall, you buy the dips and it's just fine, you may change that way of thinking with some of these newer developments.
Yeah, I think so, Andy. People got so complacent, optimism, got very, very...
buying dips, sorry to interrupt here, but buying dips when the stock's, we got a 3% sell-off. Hey, I'm getting in. An opportunity. Oh, gosh, something's down 5%. Oh, got to jump in. And that would work. And it would come back and you'd be higher before you know it in a matter of just sessions.
Yep.
But
yep.
Not the case. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think the one thing I will mention, and this is a little esoteric maybe for a lot of listeners, but it's a technical evaluation. And it's called...
And that's why we have a podcast. It's for these kind of nuggets. So go ahead.
Learn stuff, right? So it's called a key reversal. And key reversals typically happen when you're near the end of a move, whether it be a big rally or a large decline. And what a key reversal is where prices make a higher high than the day before, a lower low than the day before. So you're looking at a bar chart showing high, low, and close. And then if it's a negative, in other words, at the end of an uptrend, you get a higher high, a lower low, and a lower close. If you're coming off a bottom, you'd get a lower low, a rebound to go to a higher high, and close up. So the thing, I made a big deal on March 8th. Every major average had a key reversal where they were all higher on the day and then dropped fairly dramatically. On April 4th, there was a second key reversal where the same thing happened. So my point is, the key reversal signifies exhaustion. In other words, during the course of the day, prices were up. And then it's like the buyers just kind of got exhausted and there were no buyers. And all of a sudden, it didn't take much selling pressure to have the market reverse hard and take out the prior day's low and close down. So that's a sign of distribution. To have two of them close is, I think, a big-time warning. In my recent letters after the April 4th one, I noted that if you go back to July and August of last year, there were a number of key reversals in all the major averages. So that was a warning. The S&P ultimately declined by 10%. So we've had two in every major average. And then yesterday, interestingly enough, the Dow Jones added a third key reversal. So I think the transports may have as well. So,
and then that's and you mentioned something we talk a lot about on this podcast is the transports. We often see it as one of the ultimate leading indicators. And that's one of the things that we've been kind of waiting for. There's been some recent weakness in the transports, and that was an eye opener. And like you said, that reversal on the Dow to kind of finish out the trifecta on the big dogs.
Yep. So the transports have had three key reversals, March 8th, April 4th, and yesterday, April 15th. All right. Now, the semiconductors have been key to this market and kind of the glue holding it together. What's interesting is that the semiconductors had a key reversal on March 8th. They had a key reversal on April 4th. And they had another one yesterday, Andy, on April 15th. NVIDIA has been the darling workhorse for the market. And NVIDIA had a third key reversal yesterday as well. So to me, the leading sector that everyone in stock, that everyone's been so focused on is being, hey, as long as NVIDIA is doing okay, and the artificial intelligence story with the semiconductors, these are severe or I think important warning signs that these, the stock and the semiconductors are getting set up to have a decline. And if they break, I think the whole market will experience another wave of weakness because they've been looked at as being impenetrable and invincible. And when when that sector that's been holding everything up finally gives way, there's nowhere to hide then. So to me, these are the warning signs that I think there's more weakness coming over the next 4 to 6 weeks. If during this decline, Andy, the S&P declines below 4607, which was the high last July, to me, that would imply that the top is in and that we have likely entered a bear market. So we're not there yet. You know, these are all like clues. You know, you're turning little pieces of a puzzle over to find out, okay, give me some hints in terms of where things are going. So from a roadmap, those are some of the things that I'm looking at as a guidepost that, all right, if the S&P drops below 4607, that will overlap the high from last July. And I think that would be a significant negative. There's reasons why, we don't need to get into, glazing people's eyes over, but right. It is, I think, would be important.
The one piece I don't think is a real big factor here, and they're put, they start to put some weight on it, is I don't think the geopolitics is a real threat to the market right now. I think some of the other things that we talk about are way bigger issues. I mean, things can get out of control, yes, and I'm not saying they're a non-factor, but they're certainly not as big of a factor. And just even recent things between Israel and Iran, I think Iran gave Israel a bit of a an off-ramp, so to speak, by basically showing their hand and how they were going to respond. And I think a lot of some of the other issues, are really not the big threat here. I think it's the stuff, the economic stuff that we've talked about. And so as we wrap up the Gains podcast, do you agree with that kind of mindset and wrap up our conversation? We've covered a ton of ground here as well, Jim.
Well, I agree with you, Andy. We have to go with what we know and what we've just discussed in terms of the outlook for the economy, the technical aspects that we talked about. That stuff we can have a high degree of confidence in terms of, okay, this is what we're looking at. The geopolitical stuff can be a problem. You and I talked about the 17-year cycle, I think one or two visits ago. And going back to 1939, there's been a significant high in the S&P every 17 years, 1939, 56, 73, 1990, 2007. Well, in 73 and 1990, Middle East and oil were problems. You know, they were kind of front and center to a large extent. So, and that's a wild card. And that's why, to me, these key reversals that we're seeing suggest that if something does happen from a geopolitical perspective, the market is in a weaker state than it was a month ago, and it would handle it less well, you know. But I can't anticipate something like that, and so I'm going to go with just what I'm seeing, and just based on what I know, or what I think I know in terms of the economy and everything else, is I think the odds are we're going to see more weakness over the next 4 to 6 weeks going into mid to late May, and if it turns out to be, you know, something does happen geopolitically that causes even more weakness, well, that doesn't change the outlook. It just changed the magnitude of the weakness that was expected. So
I think part of the point I'm making is, you know, disasters and geopolitics, yes, yeah. I mean, if there's full-blown world war, then there's big problems. But I've seen this time after time where these are generally not market movers unless it's beyond serious.
Yeah. It's an event that kind of then goes away, like the 1987 crash. It was a big deal. It was
3 months later, they were back, by the way. I remember exactly. You know.
Yeah, it was a little longer than 3 months, but basically.
Or pretty close.
It wasn't a lasting impact because the economy was in very healthy shape in 1987. So when the crash happened, the economy easily held up. And that's what ultimately, there was a retest in December 4th of 1987 of the low in October. And then it was off, you know, to the races, not in a big way, but, you know, the economy held up and that's what made all the difference.
In an eventual big way. Because it did take off from there,
yes.
And just boom, now we're into...
Up until 1992, it was pretty continuous. So, there was a dip in 1990 based on the 17-year cycle. And obviously, 2007, you add 17 years, it's 2024. And that has been my perspective, is there is a high likely to happen in 2024 that it will be followed by a decline of 20% or more. Because that is the track record going back to 1939. So to me, every high needs to be respected because it potentially could turn into something more severe. And, you know, that's why in late March, my expectation was that the S&P would trade above 5261. And that would mark the top. It got to 5265, and you know we're obviously a couple hundred S&P points below that.
Now here's the one thing, and before I let you go, you hit on something, and you're going to have to explain it before you go. All right, you talked about the 17-year cycle. Okay, this next wave of the cycle, by the way, folks, isn't really good. And back me on this and explain all of that, and then we'll wrap up the convo. But we can't leave without kind of going into this and explaining what you're talking about. Right. And like I said, the next leg of the cycle isn't that great. So explain it all, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have a piece if somebody wants to get it, Jim Welsh Macro at Gmail. It's called The Coming Secular Bear Market. So what I've talked about over the last 6 months is if you look at Treasury yields, after they hit a high of 15 on the 10-year, 15.8% in 1981, they declined continuously until March of 2020. So every high in yields was lower, every low was lower, so you were in a well-defined downtrend that lasted for 39 years. Prior to that, there was a 36-year window of where yields did nothing but go up from 1945 to 1981. In 2022, the trend line on Treasury bond prices from the low in 1981 to the high in March of 2020 was broken decisively. to me, I think that suggests that the Treasury market has entered a new secular bear market that has the potential, if it's anything like the last 60 years, last for 30 years or more. If yields continuously work their way higher, I don't think we're going to 15% or anything like that. But on balance, if the 10-year Treasury yield works its way higher, that will compress equity valuations. Oh, by the way, what happened between 1966 and 1982? The Dow Jones Industrial Average went sideways. It hit 1,000 in 1966, and by 1982 was under 800. 16 years later, a lot of big swings. So to your point, Andy, I believe that the high that we've just seen, or if there's one more new high coming for whatever reason over the next 6 to 9 months, that it will be followed by what I would call a secular bear market in stocks. Because like night follows day, that's what happened in the 60s as Treasury yields went higher and higher into the 70s. And conversely, you know, a gigantic bull market once Treasury yields topped and came down significantly, the stock market enjoyed tremendous gains. So this is just a pendulum swinging back and forth, an ebb and flow of what happens. And I think we all know or feel in our gut that things just don't feel good. There's, you know, just stuff. You turn on the news and I don't care what political side you're on, it's like things are not working right. And to me, that's one of the components. Like in the 1970s, we had to deal with a lot of inflation. Today we have political divisiveness at a level that I've never experienced in my lifetime. And all there's repercussions for that. We don't make progress on problems. So Social Security will go bankrupt in 2034, Medicare in 2031. Does anyone believe that Congress has the courage to act to prevent those problems from developing? I don't. So you know, what that means is at some point in time, the problem is, you know, kind of like on the doorstep, and now we have to almost in panic mode respond to a crisis. And those are the kinds of things that are out of sight, out of mind for most people, but those are the kinds of things I think about. The idea that the Treasury market has entered a secular bear market is a very big deal.
All right, you've been warned. Big thanks to Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. If you want more information on some of the things we talked about and the 17-year cycle, Jim, give them your email.
Jim Welsh, macro at Gmail.
Yeah, give Jim take that email down. Reach out to Jim. He's got some, special offerings, Jim? Tell him for the Gains listener.
Absolutely. For Gains listener, I'm more than happy to send these reports out. You know, Andy's making a great effort to provide information to help you become better investors. And sometimes taking a look at the longer-term picture can be really, really helpful, especially if you're a little older, north of 50, a secular bear market would be very problematic for your retirement.
All right, so take Jim up on that. Hey, be sure to subscribe, follow, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if that's an option for you. Totally appreciate the solid there. And as always, subscribe and turn on those notifications so you know when a new Gains episode drops. We drop Gains episodes on Wednesday mornings, and I look forward to seeing you then.
A News Radio WBBM podcast, powered by Odyssey.